Welcome, and thank you for joining us for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. This week's episode is brought to you by Benizon. Get agency-branded member benefits with access from any device. Turn your benefits on with Benizon. On this week's episode, NAHU's Marcy Buckner, John Green, and Chris Hartman take a look at the results of Tuesday's midterm elections, which saw Democrats win back the House and Republicans expand their Senate majority. We'll look at the role healthcare played in this election and how the results will impact NAHU's priorities for the lame duck session and the new Congress. Before we begin, as a reminder, please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and to rate us. The podcast is posted every Friday on these platforms ahead of being distributed through NAHU's member-exclusive health policy newsletter, The Washington Update, giving you a head start on your weekly healthcare happy hour. This week's big whoop for the Washington Update podcast is a split result of Tuesday's midterm elections. Democrats picked up at least 28 seats in the House to give them their first majority since losing it in 2010, while Republicans expanded their Senate majority by a net gain of at least two seats. What are your top-line thoughts about this election, and how did they compare to your expectations going into Tuesday?
Well, it almost met my expectation for 54 seats, but Senator Heller lost in Nevada, which I had been counting on. The Reed turnout machine and the Culinary Union did very well in getting their people out and managed to edge out a win. I think that this was more of a realignment kind of election, that suburban districts that were trending are moving towards Democrats anyway, where suburban women were making a large part of the Democratic base, definitely on issues like healthcare, were moving towards Democrats, and they kind of landed in that place. And many of them were by slim margins. It wasn't by a tidal wave, so to speak. But I think that, you know, we're still getting results in, and I think that there could be as many as 35 seats at the end of the day, don't you, Chris?
Yeah, you know, as we're taping this on Thursday, we've already seen all through Wednesday races slowly be called over time on both the House and the Senate. On the Senate side, you know, when you went to bed on Tuesday night, it looked like John Tester was down. By Wednesday at noon, AP had declared in the winner. You'll see some of these other House races, particularly on some of the states that count a little quicker, like the East Coast states, seeming to sort themselves out in New York and New Jersey over the next few days. I expect some of the other states in California and Arizona, who have a reputation for taking a little bit while longer, will take the rest of the week to be declared. But overall, I think, John, you're right. The House is probably going to be somewhere around 35-seat pickup in the end. I think what you really see going on in this country is that areas that have been somewhat Democratic are now heavily Democratic, and areas that are somewhat Republican are heavily Republican. So rural America, where it was once somewhat mixed, is now overwhelmingly Republican. And urban and suburban America is now, where it was mixed, is now overwhelmingly Democratic. And that was really where I think why you see the results going different directions between the House and the Senate. In the Senate, the seats that were picked up in North Dakota, Indiana, and Missouri have very large rural components. Even in a state like Missouri, yes, you have St. Louis and Kansas City, but there's a lot of Missouri that is not those two locations. And so that explains a lot of the pickups that the Republicans saw. And in the House, if you look at those seats where most of those seats that were picked up, they're picked up in suburbia, in suburban Philadelphia, in the suburbs of New Jersey between New York and Philadelphia. And I suspect some of the races that will be called later this week will be the suburbs in California in or in around L.A. So it's not downtown only, but as you start going out to areas like Orange County and others, is really where you see things are starting to switch. A lot of that really also aligns really with the election from 2 years ago. You see Democrats picking up very heavily congressional seats that are seats that Hillary Clinton did win. Even after that, seats that Democrats picked up were nothing more than states that Donald Trump won by 5 percentage points. You didn't see any House seat flip if Donald Trump won by more than 5 percentage points. And I think that's sort of an interesting about how people are becoming more fixed into their own party and things are a little more polarized.
Dan, to your question about whether we were surprised about Tuesday's results, and of course the results are still coming in, so it feels like we can't just say Tuesday's results, but this election's results, I think we're not surprised that the Democrats are having control of the House and the Republicans are maintaining control of the Senate. The numbers might be a little bit different than we expected, but then we can also turn and look to some of the state legislatures and gubernatorial races, which I think were also very interesting. 87 of 99 legislative chambers held elections during this cycle. You'll notice I said of 99 legislative chambers. That's because most states have two chambers, a lower chamber and a higher chamber, and Nebraska only has one chamber, and so that's why it's 99 and not 100. And of course, DC is not a state, so we have our DC council and not an upper and lower chamber of a legislature. So 87 of those 99 chambers held elections. Republicans will now continue to control 61 chambers, and Democrats will control 37 chambers. Only Minnesota will have a divided legislature, meaning that the upper chamber and lower chamber will not be controlled by the same party. And this is the first time that this has happened in any state since 1914. So this is very interesting, where we're seeing the states become very partisan in how their chambers are being held. In addition to that, 36 governor races were on the ballot. 26 were Republican, 9 Democrats, and they were able to flip 7 gubernatorial seats for Democrats. So overall, at the end of the day, we're going to see 25 Republican held governor seats, 22 Democrats, and 3 states that are undecided are still looking. So we saw Georgia was attempted to be called around noon on Thursday, but Stacey Abrams has said she is not giving up. She wants every ballot to be counted, all those absentee ballots coming in. And so we're still waiting and for a few states to be confirmed on that. And then finally, on the attorney general races, we had 30 states that had elections for attorney generals. That's of 43 states that elect them. The other 7 appoint the attorney generals. Prior to the election, there were 27 Republican attorneys general and 21 Democrats attorney general. 2 were either independent or nonpartisan. And the results of this election flipped 4 seats for attorney generals to Democrats. So now that's a 31 seat for Democrats. And I'm going to talk a little bit about how all of that matters with healthcare and other pieces in just a few moments.
The split election came as voters cited healthcare as their top priority motivating their vote. Notably, in the closest elections, it was clear that voters were seeking pragmatic, bipartisan solutions to the nation's healthcare challenges and not any fundamental changes such as Medicare for All. How does this impact the legislative agenda for the new year as it relates to healthcare, and what does it mean for the future of single-payer proposals?
On single-payer, I do think it was a very good night for anti-Medicare for All, anti-single-payer. I think if you look at the conversation on the campaign in the last couple of months of the election, yes, healthcare was a huge topic, but really nobody was campaigning on Medicare for All. It did not come up in any of the competitive races. And most interestingly enough, candidates who campaigned on Medicare for All, say in the primaries, by the time we actually got to the general election in the last several months, it seemed to disappear from their campaign ads or disappear from their websites. And so you really, I think, saw an evolution of some candidates who maybe were talking about these things to get through a primary, didn't like to talk about them as much in a general election. Actually, a study was done of all the campaigns ads out there in the last 2 months, and it only showed up in one campaign commercial. If anything, it really showed up in campaign commercials that Republicans were running against Democrats and trying to tie them to Bernie Sanders and the Medicare for All movement. And so I think it was really good night for defeating that. And instead, the Democrats ran on issues like pre-existing conditions and protecting healthcare and providing choice. And so I think those sorts of messages are valuable for us in our long-term efforts to see single payer really defeated.
Pelosi has come out saying that as part of her agenda as a possible Speaker of the House, that she would like to look at alternatives to Medicare for All. So as much as we have heard this as a campaign mantra for Medicare for All, the results that we saw were for Democrats that were not fully supporting Medicare for All, and the leadership looks as though they're looking to alternatives to that moving forward in this congressional session. And to that point on the politicalization of pre-existing conditions, Democrats using that as a talking point in their campaign ads, I do want to point out we did do a number of op-eds across the country. Missouri specifically was really focusing on this with some of the campaigning that was going on in their state, and our chapter there that was really wanted to focus on making sure that folks understood exactly what the issue was regarding pre-existing condition. So some of those op-eds or letters to the editor focused instead on looking at pre-existing conditions, but also having politicians focus on the cost of care and what we're doing to drive down that, increasing choice and competition in the market. And so as some of these terms that we're used to talking about, like pre-existing conditions and Medicare for All, are becoming bumper stickers, we are also trying to make sure that during this political campaign season, we are doing our part to help educate voters on exactly what that meant. Aside from placing these pieces across the country in regards to some of the federal elections, with some of the state results that I mentioned earlier with governors, the state legislatures, and the attorneys general, I really want to point out what this means for states. So we had a number that have gone Democratic, flip in the attorneys general. As you all know, currently the Democrat attorneys general are defending the lawsuit that has to do with preserving pre-existing conditions, guaranteed issue, and the individual mandate that's slowly going through the court system. So this is going to have a huge impact on what states are going to do moving forward. It's going to also play a role in states that are going to be applying for 1332 waivers or those state relief and empowerment waivers that came out with guidance from CMS just a couple of weeks ago. In the past, we had a number of states that were kind of in a stalemate because there wasn't an agreement between the legislature and the governor. And here we're going to see, I think, a little bit more alignment on those states moving forward. We also had a number of states that passed ballot initiatives to expand Medicaid. And this is going to be huge. We had four states that passed ballot initiatives to expand Medicaid. Those were Nebraska, Idaho, and Utah. I think these are really important states to point out because many of them are seen as Republican states, and here they're agreeing to expand Medicaid, which is, of course, part of the ACA. They are joining 34 other states, so now this takes us to 37 states, and including the District of Columbia, that have expanded Medicaid, with only 14 states that have not. We really think that this will help to cover those folks that fall into the gap between not making enough to get a subsidy on the exchange, but not making low enough to qualify for Medicaid. So adding these states, I think, is going to add to the coverage that we see across America. And then again, some of these attorney general's races that we saw is going to make a big difference as we're seeing any challenges to some of the new rules that have come out through the Trump administration. As those are going into place, any challenges will come up through the states, and the state attorneys general will play a huge role in that. And I think that's what we're going to see on the state level from some of the results that we saw there.
Many states, healthcare really gets battled in the states, particularly amongst these ballot initiatives. California had several interesting ballot initiatives, including ones related to the dialysis community and others, with putting in their own medical loss ratio for dialysis carriers. Those did not pass, but I think it's just going to be part of a continuing trend of to fight out those healthcare battles really amongst state by state and initiative by initiative.
And especially with the Trump administration wanting to give more and more powers to the states, this is something that we're going to be watching even more closely as we move on.
So relative to the leadership and the changing of the gavels to the Democrats in the House, we've been getting some information about the agenda, and in particular in energy and commerce. Chairman Pallone, the new chairman, has laid out his marker for what he wants to address, and it will push back on short-term limited duration plans and association health plans and other things. So actually, I think they're almost creating a situation where we're going to have just more continued gridlock on healthcare, just generally. And so I think that all the things that Marcy's pointed out on the state level is where a lot of focus will be. It'll be regulatory issues and how states respond to that regulatory authority or not.
Yeah, I think when you look at the makeup of the House and the Senate now, while the Democrats have taken the House, they've taken on a lot of new members for moderate swing districts. So I do think, as John pointed out, they'll be looking at things like limited duration plans and AHPs and other things, but not quite as comprehensive of a Medicare for All because of the types of new members they've taken in. If anything, specifically on the Medicare for All single-payer universe, I am more worried at this point of what goes on the Senate side. We'll get into this a little later, but we lost some champions of opposing single-payer like Heidi Heitkamp, like Joe Donnelly in the Senate, and you're left with a much more liberal Democratic caucus in the Senate, combined with the fact that at least a dozen of them are running for president themselves, and they're all each trying to out-progress each other out there. I'm actually much more nervous at this point in time of what material you'll see coming out of the Senate with Bernie Sanders and others when it comes to healthcare policy than I am about the House Democrats.
We're still going to advocate on Cadillac tax repeal, on the HIT insurance tax, and actually reinsurance. I think that is something practical, bipartisan, that both sides should be in favor of because it lowers premiums.
Something else to keep in mind as we are trying to project the leaders of the House and Senate for the next congressional cycle. Many of them seem to fall into place, and we can almost assume who is going to be taking head of the leadership on November 14th. The House Republicans are getting together to vote on their leadership, and then the Democrats for the House side are getting together on November 28th to look at the leadership that they're going to have there. Many are assuming now that Nancy Pelosi will be Speaker, Sidney Hoyer assistant, and Jim Clyburn from my home district as the Democrat Majority Whip. And with that, I do want to remind everyone that as the Democrats are voting on November 28th for the leadership in the House, that is the end date for our early bird registration for Capitol Conference for you all to come and meet with your members of Congress. Registration will be open after at that, but it will increase by $100.
Unfortunately, NAHU lost several of our top allies in Congress as a result of the election. This includes Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota, who was a Senate sponsor of repealing the health insurance tax, Joe Donnelly in Indiana, who led us on changing the ACA's 30-hour workweek requirement to 40 hours, Dean Heller in Nevada, who was our champion on repealing the Cadillac tax, and in the House, Carlos Cobella in Florida for treating COBRA as credible coverage for Medicare. We're also waiting on final results for Bill Nelson's Senate race in Florida, who has been a leader on reinsurance issues, and Kyrsten Sinema's Senate race in Arizona, who has led the HIT issue while in the House. How does this impact NAHU's legislative priorities for the incoming Congress? And how does HUPAC help us to build new relationships with the more than 80 new members of Congress?
The most important way that we can help to build relationships with members of Congress is with your participation in Capitol Conference this February. I know I mentioned earlier that the early bird registration ends on November 28th. We do want to encourage you all to come because we are going to have so many new members of Congress. Hopefully by that time when you're here in February, John, Chris, and myself will have had the opportunity to meet with many of those new members of Congress. But with you all coming here, that's one way that we can introduce ourselves, let them know what our priorities are, let them know the role that you play in your communities and with constituents, and really promote the priorities for NEHU. Another thing I want to point out with that list that Dan mentioned is you heard names of Republicans and Democrats on that list that were our champions that were not reelected. And so it really goes to the bipartisanship that NEHU and HUPAC supports when we're working on these issues in Congress. And not all of those seats flipped one way or the other. So those seats are being replaced with members on both sides of the aisle. And we're going to continue to work on both sides of the aisle going forward on our priorities that those members had helped us with in the past.
It is a difficult blow. I mean, it's a big blow. It's a lot of work to get a bill, get someone to agree to co-sponsor or champion the bill. And we'll have our work cut out for us. The sooner we can relaunch these bills, though, in the session, the greater chance we have of getting something to the floor. So we don't want to delay in meeting them, explaining the issues, and rebuilding, you know, getting our bills back out there again. We have a lot of good relationships already with even those who are replacing people who lost their races, who were champions. So it's not like we're starting from total scratch, but it is, we are starting over again.
Yeah, I think on a lot of these issues, it is disappointing that I would say our lead person in some of these cases did lose. But in several of these cases, there's more than one member of Congress who've been working on them. If you take the issue of the health insurance tax, yes, Heidi Heitkamp was the lead Democrat on this issue. But I would also look towards other Democrats who can move into that mold. For example, we don't know the outcome of the Arizona race, but Kristen Sinema was the lead Democrat on the hit tax in the House. If she comes to the Senate, that is another possibility. If you also look at the House hit tax bill, Jackie Rosen is a co-sponsor of that, repealing the hit tax in the House. She has won a Senate seat in Nevada. So those all become logical places that you begin those conversations for future leaders where they've already taken strong stands on these issues, and we can work with them to become leaders of these issues going forward.
I will say something else that I learned today about the composition of the new Congress, and that is that there are 99 women in the Democratic side coming, 19 Republican women. I recognize the big disparity in the numbers between the two parties, but I think that number of women in Congress is a real achievement and should be applauded by both sides.
Yes, and to that point, 95 women won or are projected to win in the House because we do still have some undecided races. 13 women won in the Senate in addition to 10 current female senators that are in Congress. And to just list some of the historic firsts of this year, and this is the largest number of women that we've had in Congress ever. And just a toast to many of them and some other firsts, not just first for women, we do have, and I'm going to list them off because I think it is such an accomplishment. And I also think that the diversity that I'm going to mention here, not just gender, but also background and cultural diversity, is also going to be very important. You all know the diversity that you work with when you're working with your clients. Not all health insurance plans are a fit for one person. That's why there are so many different plans that you all help your clients to determine what the best fit is for them. And so with having a diverse Congress, I think this will really represent the diversity of the different types of plans that you work with when you're working with your clients. And so some of these firsts are Ivana Pressley, the first Black woman in Congress from Massachusetts, Marsha Blackburn, first woman elected to the Senate from Tennessee, Jared Polis, the first openly gay man elected governor in Colorado, Johanna Hayes, Connecticut's first Black woman in Congress, Deb Haaland and Cherise Davids, America's first Native American women in Congress, Veronica Escobar and Sylvia Garcia, Texas's first Latinas in Congress, Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, America's first Muslim women in Congress, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, America's youngest woman ever elected to Congress at 29. I am feeling a little unaccomplished by that statistic. And she is closely behind Elise Stefanik, who was elected at age 30 in 2014. Kristi Noem, the first female governor of South Dakota, Cindy Axne and Abby Finkenauer, Iowa's first women in the U.S. House, Janet Mills, the first female governor of Maine. And of course, more history can be made with some of the undecided votes that are out there, both in some of the governor's races in House and Senate. So we'll keep you updated on those.
Before these new members are sworn into office, Congress will be back for a few short weeks of a lame duck session. How does the result of Tuesday's election impact what will get done in the lame duck, and what is NAHU seeking to get passed?
Well, we've been doing a lot of Hill visits, even during this period of the election, to find out that very answer about what are they going to do during lame duck. And we still can't get an answer. It's always, well, we have to wait till our boss comes back and we'll see what the temperature is and they have conference. So that's been sort of the mantra. However, I have heard that some of the issues that we do care about could be on the agenda, such as Cadillac tax extension or repeal and the HIT tax. And we've stressed that it needs to be done now because for two reasons. One is it's possible that when Democrats take control of the House next year, they're going to implement PAYGO, which will complicate the ability to move those pieces of legislation due to offset needs and things like that. So for everything that you do that has a cost, you have to have an offset to complement that cut or cost to the government.
Yes. So on something like Cadillac tax, with how much the Cadillac tax is projected to bring in, would be difficult for us to find money to offset that.
Should they implement that? And it's interesting because 81% of voters believed in continuing to support the employer exclusion and employer tax preferential treatment for providing health care to their employees. And so with that combined with this possibility of changing the rules on how some of these bills are introduced, I think that will be a really interesting dichotomy if it's to come to light.
And as a practical matter for plans who have to calculate into their pricing whether there's a HIT tax, a premium tax, or, you know, how the impact of a Cadillac tax would play on the plans going forward, they need time to do those analyses.
Yeah, so I think when looking about what can be achieved in the lame duck, I think some of it will depend. Probably we'll get a better idea of this next week when the members of Congress are back, like John says. But there's some questions that I think need to be answered on issues that have nothing to do with healthcare. For example, the president wants to see funded right now, funding for a border wall. I think that will be the first and top of the discussion for the lame duck session. And then I think things start to play in after that. If there is some sort of compromise in there, then maybe that is the time where things like the Cadillac tax, the HIT tax, employer reporting can be packaged in. However, if it goes the other way, where there is no compromise on this subject, we could be headed towards a government shutdown instead. So I think that's the sort of things we need to see how they play out first before I can tell you how things play out for the Cadillac tax and the HIT tax. So really issues that you don't think of dealing with healthcare are what you should be looking towards to read the tea leaves first. And I think this border wall is what you should be paying attention to when you want to see if we're going to get a delay or repeal of the Cadillac tax.
So they have to do some things. They have a CR up until December 7th, and so they have to fund the government. And I kind of use that as the marker or the deadline, sort of, if you will, artificial deadline as to when they would like to get out of here. So if we have a government shutdown, those things eat away at the calendar, and it's only about 2 weeks' time, and it takes that long to put a package together of agreement, just even to fund the government. So adding other things in there is going to require cooperation and agreement, and that's where it gets difficult.
Yeah, I think the bright side here is October, while the politicians were out campaigning, many here in Washington were spending our times making sure these issues were ready to be on the table for lame duck. So the meetings to discuss the HIT tax, the Cadillac tax, employer reporting, HSA's reforms have taken place, the ones that need to take place so that people have it on their radar screen so that it makes it into the conversations, discussions. That sort of groundwork laying has been done very successfully. And so now it's some larger issues we need to see, many of which are out of our control, but at least we have a seat at the table.
This year's midterm election drew historic turnout with high enthusiasm both among Democrats and Republicans, many of whom were drawn in support of relatively new candidates that ultimately lost, some by very narrow margins. What are your thoughts on many of these up-and-comers, such as John James in Michigan, Beto O'Rourke in Texas, Richard Ojeda in West Virginia, and Maria Elvira Salazar and Andrew Gillum in Florida? Where do you see them in the next few years?
Well, according to one of my Uber drivers earlier this week, he's expecting to see Gillum on the presidential campaign. I don't think he's the only one who thinks that. I think that others expect Beto O'Rourke to use this as a platform for some type of national campaign.
I do think that John James in Michigan is someone to keep an eye on the Republican side. He wasn't supported by the NRSC. He had very little national backing, and yet he still managed to achieve about 46-47% of the vote against an established Democrat. So I think that there is a hunger out there for some new fresh faces and new personalities. I think Beto O'Rourke is a classic example in Texas. I think had he been a little bit more moderate in Texas, he might have had a real chance to win this thing. I think he got swamped by, you know, the number of Republicans in Texas.
And these close races, I think, especially looking on the Democratic side, since you were looking on the Republican side, John, I think also highlight similar themes, like you mentioned, of looking for fresh faces, looking for younger faces. I think the Democratic Party was really struggling to see if there was going to be anyone on the horizon for presidential campaigns other than Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker. And I think now there's some faces that may help to shape the campaigns. They may not be running, but will definitely be a voice in some of these states and across rest of the nation. I also think that the parties are recognizing this as well. And some reports I saw where there was a little bit of doubt as to whether Nancy Pelosi would win the Speaker of the House or if she would take it. If she did win, there were reports that Representative Clyburn, one of the oldest serving African American representatives in the House now, was offering to serve as a bridge speaker if needed for 1 to 2 years, but not to really take that full position. And his intention as a bridge speaker would be to bridge that gap over to the new generation. And of course, this is looking in the House. And I think that statement is also very apropos to what we're seeing on the national level as well for possibly some of these folks coming up and being either partners in a campaign or just being a voice and supporting some presidential campaigns. 2020 now is just around the corner.
I think what happened in Salazar was that kind of what happened the opposite in Indiana and Missouri, where Republicans came home and voted for the Republican ticket. Democrats migrated back to the Democratic Party. But I've met her, and she had a lot of charisma. She was a real dynamo, and her timing was just off this cycle. But we could see her again.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to keep in mind, everyone Dan listed here did lose on Election Day. So while I think some of these might run for other offices, try again, I would be really interested in looking at some of the new members who've made it to Congress, who won this election. Somebody like Mikey Sherrill in New Jersey, 30-something-year-old woman who was a Army helicopter pilot. I think some of these sorts of people are going to be strong leaders in the government, in their freshman class, who can really start making a difference. Some of them have spoken very strongly about working across the aisle to get things done. I think this new energy, this younger energy, this new vibe that has many more women in it, a much younger overall class, many more veterans on both sides of the aisle, are the type of people who are used to getting things done in their career. If there's one thing the military teaches you, is that you have to be accomplished. You can't just have ideas that you're throwing around. The goal in the military is always to get things done. And I'm hoping that this freshman class that's coming in are people who are ready to hit the ground running and get things done. So to me, the real highlights are a much younger freshman class coming in than ever before, much more diverse freshman class than ever before. And so I'm looking forward to working with them to see getting things done.
It's time for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hours Toast of the Week. With the political campaign ads over, what are we toasting to this week?
This week, we are toasting to Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She had a fall and is in the hospital with 3 broken ribs. Regardless of your political party, I think we can all agree that she has been a true champion of justice on the Supreme Court. And we wish her a healthy recovery and a speedy return to the bench.
Cheers!
Thank you for joining us for this week's episode of the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, brought to you by Benizon. Get agency-branded member benefits with access from any device. Turn your benefits on with Benizon. For more information on NAHU's government affairs efforts, or to join as a member of NAHU, visit NAHU.org.